sandwich. He made a fuss at nap time. Oh, naughty bunny. The little bunny didn't nap until he heard his mother coming. Oh, what a dear, darling bunny he is when he is asleep, she thought. Please turn the page. After his nap, his mother sent the little bunny out to play. He chased a fly in his father's workshop. He visited the chickens in the barnyard and left the gate open behind him. Oh, naughty bunny. Can you see that all the chickens got loose? Please turn the page. When his father came home, he asked, "Has he been a good little bunny?" His mother answered, "Oh yes, he has been just the best little bunny. Daddy gave the little bunny a present for being so good." They sat down to supper. Please turn the page. The little bunny kissed his mother goodnight, and his daddy gave him a piggyback to bed. Instead of going right to sleep, the little bunny wanted a glass of water. He wanted to go to the bathroom. His mother went into his room to make him go to sleep. She told him that it made her very sad when he was naughty. The little bunny loved his mother dearly and didn't like to see her sad. He told her he was going to try very hard to be a good bunny tomorrow.
Gather all your things.
Children, it's time. Otis G. Johnson behind us now. It is time to go home. It's from the great, great Personal Space Comp, Electronic Soul, 1974 to 1984. We heard Cecilia Scott reading Richard Scarry's Naughty Bunny from a little special golden record. J.D. Emanuel, great double LP called Time Traveler, we heard At One Meant. Annika covers EP, we heard In the City. AR and Machines, As If I Had Seen All This Before, from great 2-CD soul jazz comp, Deutsche Elektronische Musik 2. And we heard a loop of the Velvet Underground's What Goes On guitar solo at the top of the set. And that ends the show. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is Scott. Stay tuned for Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information coming right up. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. I'll see you next week.
Please turn the page.
You're listening to Too Much Information on WFMU. My name is Benjamin Walker. Today, we have a very special guest joining us live in the studio. Keo Stark has coming in to talk about her new book, Don't Go Back to School. But first, I'm going to play an interview I did the other day with the filmmaker Olivier Assayas. His new movie, Something in the Air, just opened up this past weekend. The film set at the beginning of the 70s, Gilles, a high school student in Paris, is swept up by the political fever of the time, but his real-life dream is to make art, something his friends can't relate to. For them, politics is everything. The French title for this movie is Après May, which is, of course, May 1968. So when I called Olivier, up in France, I asked him, is this a movie set in the afterglow of revolutionary times, or more like an echo?
It's a different perspective depending on if you are looking back on it or if you try to remember how it felt when you were living it. When you were living it, it did not feel like the aftermath of anything. It felt mostly like the threshold of new times. It felt like the world was going to change. Some revolution was coming that would sweep away the old world. So it's as much as May 68, the student rebellion in France was a defining moment in French radical culture. It felt like a dress rehearsal. I mean, the big one was coming, and in the early 70s when I was growing up, the kids were very naive, and we had this notion that the best was yet to come. But then, of course, if we are looking back on it, we realize that whatever was going on in the early 70s in France was, it was the echo of the libertarian, the anarchist uprising of May 68 and the world. The politics were, of course, very important, but society was changing in profound ways.
So the movie opens with your cast, a very young cast, you know, voicing these political opinions and convictions. But, you know, since they're high schoolers, it has this, I mean, at least for me, from 2013, looking back, this very precious absurdity to it. I mean, I don't think I know a single high schooler who has any even interest in politics, at least certainly
yes,
here.
You know, that was the most, not surprising, but I did not realize the extent. I did not realize how much that whole culture was gone. And I did not realize how the relationship to social history was gone. I mean, you know, it's really interesting. Like, you know, it's like a forgotten language. And in the 70s, in the early 70s, in a French high school, everybody was involved in discussing politics, in discussing nuances of radical politics. I mean, and you had to define yourself because you had so many groups and subgroups. You had like four or different Trotskyite groups. You had Maoists. You had anarchists. You had whatever. It's and you had to be very clear about your position. And it's not just the interest in the past. It's because people were so convinced that, you know, a major revolution was coming. So they were kind of learning from the mistakes of the past and to hopefully get it right next time. The next time never happened.
Yeah, but there's still something that kind of transcends this period, you know, just, I guess, the questions of youth, where, you know, how do I contribute?
Yes.
How do I find my own aesthetics, you know?
There are things that are eternal and universal about youth. It's an age when you don't know much about yourself and don't know much about the world, and you try to fit in, you try to figure out where your place is and what you can do, what you can't do, and you're pushing, and it's a moment of questioning, it's a moment of self-discovery, and everything was more extreme in the 1970s, and including that, because it's a very special experience coming of age in a world that is in complete chaos. You have, like, really nothing to lean on. So there is a very specific 1970s dimension to this story, but ultimately it tells the story of any youth when you it's always about do you share the values of your age group? Do you fit in? Don't you fit in? And how are you going to find your own path? And basically what Gilles does, and he does it the same way any kid his age does it, except he does it into a world, in the middle of a world that's in major turmoil. Yeah.
What was it like working with, you know, young actors from today, playing these, you know, young characters from the past? Did you learn anything about convictions? You know, like how these young people...
I think I learned from them as much as they learned from me. I mean, they don't have the difficulty relating to the music. They don't have difficulty relating to the clothes. But of course, when we start discussing politics, their perspective on politics, even for kids who are extremely politicized, is very different from whatever the 70s were about. Because the 70s believed in the future. They believed in like transforming society, like in major ways. Whereas politics today are about amending modern society. It's basically about fixing what's deadly wrong. But there's not this utopian notion that that what is to come is a completely new set of values.
Yeah, one of the young actresses is from here in New York, and I've never had this experience before, but I recognize her from just being in my neighborhood. You know, I think one of her first, but she has this very striking long red hair, India,
yes.
Salvor Menez, and I finally realized I think I just know her from the neighborhood, and then I looked it up later, and I was right.
But, yes, no, and she's brilliant. I love her. I mean, she's a very talented artist.
Yeah.
I basically knew her not as not as someone who wanted to act, but someone who's mostly an artist and his and love her work.
Yeah, but how do you find, you know, such fresh faces for you? I mean, yeah, for you when you're working with new actors, do you spend a lot of time?
It was very much what making this film was about. I mean, I really wanted to go back to working with very young actor to somehow be in touch with the energy of teenagers, and because I think that cinema is so much about that energy, and I think that the movies today, I mean, they get the kids very wrong. I mean, there's a very caricature representation of what teenagers are about. I mean, I think they are often much more serious, much deeper, and much more involved in big ideas than what than it's made up what it's made up to be, what I loved was, of course, the spontaneity. I mean, you know, there's something. I mean, they give everything. It's the first time they're in a movie, and I try to help them forget it's a movie. I try to give them a sense that they are living through those times, that that stuff is somehow happening around them. I try to give them as little pressure as I can, but I try, you know, just to throw them in those situations, and I'm just fascinated by the way they react, the way they absorb them, the way they you know, it's something you don't get with actors.
Yeah. You know, the music you use in this new film, I'm dying to ask you about this. It seems that if you made a mixtape for someone back when, you know, people actually made those sorts of things, would a lot of these songs be on it? I mean, they seem like they're very personal songs of yours.
Yes, I mean, it's the soundtrack to this film is as autobiographical as you can get. I mean, you know, it's really the stuff I was listening at that age. You know, it's kind of interesting because when I was making Cold Water, I used, like, the bigger names. Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Janis Joplin, Creedence Clearwater Revival, whatever, you know. But it was stuff I loved. It was stuff I listened to, of course. But it was the taste that I did share with the majority in my generation, whereas in Something in the Air, ultimately it's an homage to, like, to the British underground or something. You know, it's an homage to the stuff I really loved, and you know, that was the thing that really I really had a hard time sharing with the other kids, because, you know, it was some of them did get Nick Drake or Syd Barrett or Captain Beefheart, but not certainly not the majority. It was just like a tiny, tiny group. And I was extremely faithful to the music I was listening at that time, meaning some of the music has stayed, meaning, you know, Syd Barrett. I mean, even the kids in the film, they say, oh, wow, you're using Syd Barrett music in your film, or Nick Drake. But then They had never heard of Kevin Ayers. They had, and of course, they had never heard of, you know, of obscure bands like Amazing Blondel or Stuff is Strangely Strange. But it's stuff that I loved, and I listened to that stuff when I was that age.
Did they know Soft Machine at least?
Hardly.
That seems the one band that makes it into the film itself. The girl's parents are working on the light show. That's why she's.
Yeah, I know. But because it's, you know, Soft Machine was a big deal in France. in the 70s. I mean, they were, because they played a lot in France. They had this kind of Parisian connection. They would play at, like, leftist events, blah blah. And also, you know, in France, you have to keep in mind that in the 70s, what the music leftists loved was not rock. Rock was petit bourgeois. What they loved was free jazz. And somehow, Soft Machine had jazz credentials, so they were, you know, they were adopted. They were, they were one of the, you know, popular within, you know, the mod, you know, the countercultural milieu of English bands.
Our hero walks away at the very end of the film, seeming to have realized something very important. And if you had to put that into words, what is that?
Oh, he understands. At the end, he's sitting in this theater, and he's, you know, he has been attracted by cinema, but he just doesn't understand where his position is in cinema. He doesn't want to become a militant filmmaker. He doesn't want to do, you know, stupid 9-to-5 job in a film studio. So he walks into this movie that has this experimental film program. And then he realizes two things. One, that whatever cinema means to him has to do with the freedom of independent filmmaking and eventually experimental filmmaking, certainly out of the industry. And also he understands that the reason why he has wanted to make movies in the first place is because movies have something personal to say to him. And they say something deeply personal through the resurrection of his lost love. You know, cinema has the power of reconciling yourself with the past, of reviving the past, and in many ways, that's very much what all art should be about or is about. And I think he kind of at that we live in at the beginning of his path. I mean, he has like this kind of sparkle that kind of just shows him the way, and we leave him very much at the start of a long path. But at least he's on his own track.
Yeah. No, it's a really beautiful film, and thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
So that's the director Olivier Assayas talking with me somewhere in the French countryside. You could hear his children in the background. So his new movie, Something in the Air, opened up this past weekend here in the New York City area. Definitely one of the better films out right now. You are listening to Too Much Information on WFMU. My name is Benjamin Walker. And our next guest for the rest of the hour, joining us for the rest of the hour, is Keo Stark, an author and independent learning activist. She's just published a book called Don't Go Back to School, a handbook for learning almost anything. And now she joins us for the rest of the hour live. Welcome to WFMU, Keo.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
Yeah, no, it's great that you could come all the way down here. So I want to ask you first, what exactly is this book? The last time I checked, higher education was, you know, the key to financial and personal success. What exactly are you doing here with this message, don't go back to school?
Well, I'm trying to tell you that you don't have to go back to school for your education, for your financial success, for your own happiness. That learning isn't locked up in universities.
And what set you off on deciding to do this?
I am a teacher and a grad school dropout, and for some reason
So it's like self-justification.
Yeah, exactly. So, for some reason, everybody thought that I would have the line on whether or not they should go back to school. Hmm. So people ask me this all the time. And when I asked them why they wanted to go back, it was always about learning and not about, well, I need this for my job. So it seemed like, well, you can learn without going to school, so why would you pay all that money? And they would look at me blankly, like, what do you mean? How do I do that? And I wanted to have a sort of user's manual to give them, and that didn't exist. So I wrote one.
So if you, back when you decided to go to grad school and before you dropped out, if you had come across this book, would that have made an impression on you?
I think so, yeah. I did go to graduate school right out of undergrad because I thought, I want to keep learning. This is so fun. And nobody really told me that graduate school is professional school for professors.
Uh-huh. What did you get at, what did you go to study?
I went to Yale.
Okay. No, what did you go to study?
Oh, American Studies, which is already kind of amorphous.
Yeah.
So I went through 2 years of coursework, and it's a very Marxist department.
That's what they say in the media.
Yes. So I was taking classes with all these very wonderful, very politically astute professors who were essentially not involved in the world of politics. And mm-hmm. one day that seemed like a bit of a contradiction to me. And so I decided to go take a walk in the real world and see what
So it was very like a sudden decision.
Mostly, yeah. I'm that kind of person.
Okay. So did you find yourself, when you were putting this book together, writing for this young Keo Stark?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think so, to some degree. You know, particularly thinking about what kinds of questions people would have about how to do this and why they should do it. I do think that if this book had existed and I had found it as a 20-year-old thinking about going to graduate school, I might have made a different decision.
Well, plus it also seems that there must be, you know, experiences from actually the 3 years you did spend mm-hmm. in grad school. I mean, like, no one would want to read a book on heroin addiction from a non-heroin addict. So it seems that, you know, I'd love for you to talk about some of the things that you know that you wouldn't have been able to put into this book if you hadn't gone.
Sure. I mean, some of it is knowing actually for myself how to go about learning in a rigorous way. So I had a year before the dissertation where I was sent away to read, and I got to make up 4 fields that I was supposed to make myself an expert in, at least enough to stand up in front of a class and mm-hmm. talk about them. So I went off into the woods, basically, with a lot of books and a library and read them all and had to figure out how to make a coherent narrative out of that and to figure out which books were talking to each other and what different factions were telling the same story. And that's the part where I really learned everything and anything.
When you were in the woods?
Well, the woods is an exaggeration. Okay. But yeah, when I was in the woods, it was the point where I came out and I felt like I know some stuff here. Like, I know some actual facts and some facts that are in contradiction with each other. And if you ask me about the history of 19th century working class, I can tell you a few things.
And then you decided that you didn't need to stick in the system to finish the dissertation, or?
I started it, and then having figured out that it was professional school for professors, and I didn't actually want to be a professor, I sort of tried to work it both ways, and I came up with what I thought was going to be a real nonfiction project, and I dazzled my advisors into approving it, but then in the end, they really wanted a real dissertation.
Yeah.
So I just walked.
You walked.
Yeah.
Now, when you listen in on or read conversations about our education system today, it seems that there's a pretty large number of people who agree that it's broken. And this seems to lead most of the conversation to be about educational reform, how to fix it. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious for you, when you decided to take on this project, did you address the issue of reform, or was this like full on bypass? Like, I'm skipping that.
It's pretty much a bypass. I think reform is an amazing project that other very smart people are engaged in, and I'm not sure if it's going to work, but it's just not my area of expertise. And it's not what I was really interested in. Mm. I'm interested in making sure there are alternatives for people to learn outside of school. And that's got nothing to do with reform. That's sort of revolutionary, actually.
Yeah, you actually have this great line in the introduction where you say that the reform misses the whole fundamental problem. That's kind of a pretty large accusation to make at the reformers. That's heavy.
It is heavy. And I think it's really true. I think that they're trying to reform an institution that has a lot of problems, and that in the meantime, outside of the institution, people are finding other ways to learn, and in a lot of ways, they're finding that to be better learning. So all of the conversations that are about fixing school are kind of, you know, faculty coffee room conversations as far as I'm concerned. They're insider baseball, and I wish them really well. But in the meantime, I think the really interesting things are going on outside.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some of the individuals you do talk to in this book. But I want to, you know, come to the issue of technology first. You do some pretty serious work with technology. Currently, you're running the Knight Mozilla Open News Learning Project for journalist developers and civic data news hackers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I'm really curious. It seems that for a lot of big institutions and big money, for them to get past the idea of, I mean, they're not getting past the idea of reform because they think they can just fix it all with computers.
Do you mean the sort of massive classes?
Yeah, there just seems like a lot of investment in time and money and institutions into trying to take on what's wrong with the educational system with computers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem that those massively online open classes, which are called MOOCs, that they're trying to solve is scaling up teaching. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, we have this resource, which is teaching, and we want to broadcast it wide and loud. The problem is that teaching isn't really the only or most important thing that goes on in a classroom. Learning is the most important thing. And MOOCs are not designed to scale up learning. So they're basically a school-like experience that's online. And that's, to my mind, not a very creative use of technology.
No. So you're interested in really the solution being, the bypass being about learning, not about the teaching.
Learning and particularly connecting learners with each other. So if you've ever taken a MOOC, you'll see that they do have discussion forums, but they're pretty badly organized as ways of making little communities for people to learn in.
So I think for me, it's always been the economics that makes this idea so obvious or relevant, especially right now, you know, coming out of a recession when, you know, wages are going down and the cost of education is going up and up and up. And grad school is kind of obscenely expensive. And, you know, while you do have maybe some, you have a good chance of making some money going to law school or medical school. It seems going to get an American studies degree or a liberal arts degree, it's, you know, there's, you can shell out, you know, $100,000 plus or a degree in journalism or an MFA, and you're not, it's probably not, I mean, statistically proven that it's probably a really bad risk, bad idea.
Yeah, there's not a lot of jobs for new academics, and the story is that we've been overproducing professors for quite a long time, so there's a scarcity of jobs. So you put in all this time and energy and research in the archives and all this money, and it's not just your tuition, you have to support yourself, and possibly if you're lucky enough to get like teaching assistant jobs, you get very poorly paid for doing those.
But we all know this. Yeah. But you having researched this, like, how bad really is it?
How bad really is it?
Is it like the situation of the over, the too many numbers of churned out PhDs every year?
Well, I dropped out in the mid-90s, and it was already the conversation then that there were way too many of us and not enough jobs. And so if you weren't a superstar, you really didn't have a hope. And if you were a superstar, you might be able to get a job in a place that wasn't particularly where you wanted to live.
Flyover country.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not trying to say something bad about our neighbors in flyover country. It's just that's really where the only few openings will be. And, you know, uprooting yourself from your friends and your family is hard.
Right, definitely. Graduate school is also quite infantilizing. I mean, you know, you're put into the system as an adult, and you're continue to be treated like a student and not given full responsibility for things, and you're accountable to your mentors or masters or however
masters.
You think of them. Yeah. So it's not a great experience for a lot of people. And then, I was lucky and I had a fellowship.
Yes.
So it wasn't as big of a decision for me because I wasn't going to go into any debt to do this. If I hadn't had a fellowship, I wouldn't have had the money to go. And
you could have borrowed it.
But I don't think I would have made that decision, particularly because I was 20 and it just was this sort of abstract pleasure of I would like to keep hanging out in the library.
And doing that for being paid, even if it's a little bit of money, you are 20, that makes sense. But going into, you know, $100,000 of debt. But then again, you know, back in the 90s when we're talking about when there weren't enough jobs and there were too many newly minted PhDs being turned out every year, the prices are not the same today, right?
No, not at all.
Like how bad is it now?
You know, I don't have, like, generalized numbers, but I teach as an adjunct at a kind of a funky program at NYU called the Interactive Telecommunications
Program. Lots of people like to think about going there.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of people ask me, should I apply there? Should I go there?
Yeah, and it's great. It's so interesting, and it is the study of the recently possible, and it's really exciting. I teach there as an adjunct because I love it, and I don't get paid very well. I kind of get a return on that in my own learning because teaching is a really great way to learn. And so if you teach half of a class of books that you've only read for the first time recently, then, you know, you're getting to really dig into them. But anyway, the point is it's really expensive and all the students come out with an extraordinary amount of debt.
Yeah.
So when I was working on this book, I had probably five or six people call me or email me who were applying to the program and wanted me to tell them whether they should go or not. And it was such an interesting conversation that I actually took some real time to talk to these people yeah. and ask them, well, what do you want to get out of it? And one or two of them, I said, yeah, you know, if you have the money or if you're not afraid of the debt, I think you're going to get a lot out of this program. And there were at least two of them who I just said, you're not going to get that there. So why would you pay the money for it?
Yeah.
And another thing that happens is that because of the project, I got a lot of people just randomly emailing me and asking for advice on whether they should go back to school.
Yeah. Oh.
And this turned out to be really lovely because I would ask them, well, what do you want to learn? And they would tell me, and I would write back and give them as much concrete advice as I could. You could do this, you could do this. If it's technology, you could find a hackerspace or this, use this kind of list. And inevitably, they wrote back to me and said, oh, I'm already doing that. And all they really wanted was validation that this was a legitimate way to do things and that they were on the right track.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think a lot of that comes from it's just brand new. I mean, we have probably more people, or at least a larger number of people trying something like this now. And
yeah.
And for me, it seemed like there must be a tipping point. Recently with the economics, the cost going so high that you're just looking at a piece of paper that says, okay, I'm going to go do this and I'm going to owe this much money that I think that a lot of people are looking for other answers, and now they have your book. So you're listening to WFMU. My name's Benjamin Walker. This is Too Much Information. Our guest today is Kyo Stark, and we are talking about her book, Don't Go Back to School. And if you'd like some free advice about grad school, perhaps you've just perhaps there's someone out there right now, someone waking up on the floor thinking that the only way out of their horrible situation is grad school. I mean, that's really the only time I ever thought about like going to get an MFA. It would be these dark nights of the soul where I'd be like, oh man, I'm just gonna have to go to grad school. There's no other way out. And then, you know, the sun would come out, I'd feel a little bit better myself. I'm like, that's the stupidest idea I've ever had.
Well, I'd be happy to answer questions for people who are in a little less of a black and white place.
Sure. You can give us a call. The on-air call-in number here is 201-209-9368. But Kia's going to be here for the rest of the hour. But let's talk specifically, a little bit more about this book. It's based on a number of interviews you do with people who, for the most part, didn't go to grad school.
Yeah, I actually ended up interviewing about 100 people, and they ranged from high school dropouts to people with graduate degrees. Most of them, I would say, either dropped out of college or did graduate from college. Most of the people who did graduate from college told me that they didn't really value that much what they had learned there, and that everything they knew about what they were doing now is something they learned on their own outside of school.
So if you fed this into the computer and you had all these data points, what would be sort of the things that across the board, or was there anything that for the majority of them had?
Yes. There were a lot of different useful themes. The main four themes were, the first is a huge one, that people don't learn by themselves. Mm. So the whole name, independent learners, is kind of catchy and it's useful and people sort of know what you mean, but it does suggest solo learning, and that is actually a total lie. People learn in communities with each other, teaching each other, learning from each other. So that's a huge thing, and everyone I talked to talked about that in one way or another.
Yeah.
Some people who are shy and nerdy were learning from other people online rather than in person. but it all counts as learning collectively.
Yeah, well, computers certainly make that easier to do. But let's dive into one of them. Katarina Rindy, it seems like a great example on this. What did she do?
Katarina Rindy was working in nonprofit administration and really wanted to start a business. And thought that she needed to go to business school to do that. And she actually applied and didn't get in. And then she thought, well, I'm going to do this anyway. Mm. And so she started a networking group with her friends. And I think it's called the Goldfish Group. That was because that was the snack they had the first time. And it was just people talking to each other about what they were trying to do with work and helping each other. And then out of that, she joined the Faux MBA reading group. which is one of my more favorite sort of specific communities. So they have kind of a curriculum which I forced them to put online. They were thinking about it anyway, but I nudged them.
Yeah.
And they would pick business school books. They decided what kinds of things that were going to be helpful and not helpful. So there was a certain segment of finance stuff that none of them were working on with their businesses. So they focused on other things. And they read stuff, and they were really rigorous, and they ran their own businesses through
Amazing.
The models that were in these books. And, you know, they got everything they needed by doing it that way.
And how many people were in this group, and how did they find each other?
That's a great question. I know that Katerina found it through a friend of hers. And then I think that she said there were 10 or 12 people in it at any given time.
So, and I guess the other model that many of your interviewees have, and I'm thinking of Astra Taylor, the writer and filmmaker, she talks about learning from others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost everybody talked about learning from others in one way or another. And the story Astra told me is about making her first film, which she didn't really know how to do, but she had seen some films that were narrative nonfiction films, and it kind of opened up a real world to her that you could make these kind of movies, that movies didn't have to be fictional narrative. So she got a grant to do a very short nonfiction film that was very practical about how to get a certain nutrient out of a tree in a part of Africa. And it was very important to the local nutrition. And so she got the job and then got a friend of hers who spoke French, which was the language in the country, and who knew filmmaking, and tagged along. And she did all the coordination and the production, but she learned about all the things that were needed, like B-roll and sound design, by watching and asking a lot of questions. And then the next time she was able to do it on her own. She also talks very frankly about the value of hiring people who know what they're doing when you have the opportunity, or collaborating with people who know what they're doing. You can learn from them, but you can also narrow the number of things you have to actually learn yourself.
But how do you keep that from just, turning cutthroat mercenary?
In what way?
I think Astra even talks about that. In a way, you're like trying to suck out as much information as you possibly can, and then move on to which, when you're thinking of a book, it sounds, pleasant. And
right.
It's less vampiric than, like an individual.
Yes. I think most of the people I talked to also specifically talked about not being a vampire, and not in those words. But it was important that when you come to an experience where you're learning from other people, that you have something to give as well.
Yeah.
One of my interviewees, Quinn Norton, even said that, and she has lots of other things to give, but she said sometimes the best thing you can do to give is to wash someone's dishes or cook them dinner. Anything you can do so that it turns into a genuine generosity rather than, let me suck the life out of you.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about this project is, I tend to shy away from DIY books, like sort of how to, because it always makes me think of that Life of Brian moment, where, like, you must learn to think for yourself, and everyone's like, yes, we must think for ourselves, and it just seems kind of preposterous about trying to get the formula how to do it for yourself. But I find that in reading, the interviews in this book that I didn't. I was able to, that didn't flare up at all. In fact, I learned a lot from some of the work. But I think that a lot of your interviewees talk about the DIY world, and especially like one of my favorite ones, Dan Sinker. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about him and about where he was coming from and the crossover?
Sure. So Dan Sinker,
been on the show before.
Okay, awesome. And he was the founder and publisher of Punk Planet for a very long time until it closed down. He's also, without having any graduate education in journalism, been a journalism professor. He now runs the Open News Project. I work for him, so that's kind of caveat. But he did graduate from college, and said that he really learned the most important things that he learned from doing Punk Planet. And the one thing that he learned in school that was extremely useful to him in Punk Planet was video editing. Hmm. Now, Punk Planet was a print publication, but he said when they started, it was actually just terrible. None of them knew how to edit. And he realized that he was borrowing the editing skills that he knew from film, and if he could apply those to textual pieces, that all of a sudden, you know, he had learned something in school that was useful. But really, he talks about how the DIY punk scene that he was coming out of very early on in high school, when he started doing zines, was just, you know, that was his school.
And yeah.
That was this very liberating scene where people were just making it up on their own and learning on their own.
And he talks about going from that life to his life as a student at the Art Institute of Chicago and how they were very, very separate worlds. But what's fascinating is that, and he talks about this and a number of your subjects do, is that those worlds are finding more and more connections between the two. In fact, one of the greatest credentials you can have is being able to do things on your own.
I think so. I mean, you know, I get all these questions about, well, how am I going to get a job?
Yeah.
And I talked to a few people who are in a position to hire people, and they all said that for them, the number one qualification is somebody who can learn on the job, who knows how to learn, who knows how to learn quickly. They don't, you know, one of the people I interviewed whose interview is in the book said, I don't care where you went to school or what degree you have or whether or not you have a degree. I don't even care whether you know what you need to know to do this job. I care whether you can figure it out fast.
Yeah.
So.
But unfortunately, the resume scanning computers, I don't know if they can do that yet. Last I checked, like, they're just like graduate school, beep, beep, no, reject.
Well, I've never actually seen one of these purported resume scanning computers. No, I think people are very nervous about that. And to some degree, if you want the kind of job that has a resume scanner, you may have a problem if you don't have the right resume.
Yeah.
Your alternative is to have some kind of chutzpah and walk in or write a different kind of letter that says, look, I don't have a degree, but I have this experience and, you know, this desire, and what's it going to hurt to try me out?
Yeah. Or to find one thing. One of your guests, I thought Jim Monroe, I believe. Yeah, Jim Monroe. He talks about a writer who says all he needed was one book.
Right.
Like having one qualification, the one that you can put in your Twitter bio.
Right.
Or the one can you talk about him and what he
sure.
has to say?
He's great. When he was very young, he wanted to be a writer, and he wrote lots of stuff, and then wrote a novel that he was really ready to submit. He got a book called How to Be Your Own Literary Agent. He sent out a bunch of, you know, cold manuscripts, meaning uninvited.
And going to the slush pile, usually.
Yeah. And he got very lucky in that somebody read it. So he is the first to say this is not like a typical story. But the book got published, and it was published by HarperCollins, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And after the novel was published, Jim felt like, okay, I have this, you know, and I don't want to work for Rupert Murdoch, so I'm going to do this myself. And he just went about in the same way that he figured out how to be a literary agent. He figured out how to publish his own books, and he makes a living that way. He continues to publish his own books. He's very, very generous in sharing everything he knows about the economics and the process. Then more recently, he decided he wanted to make films, and he kind of approached it the same way, like, let's just do this. The great part of his interview is when he talked about how he made all these mistakes, and because he made them in a real context, he learned things in a very different way than you would in film school. The importance of sound. Anyone will tell you that sound is important. Well, he messed it up, and then he figured out why it's important and in what kind of subtle ways.
So we have Keo Stark here on the show today. We've got about another 17 minutes. You can give us a call at 201-209-9368 if you want some advice about not going back to school. But I have something on the playlist page at WFMU.org. This is Dan Pfeiffer writing in here. He says, hello, we are listening to your show with my digital art class at NYU Steinhardt, and we have a question. How can we trust the information that isn't vouched for by an educational institution? That's and he writes in that he is a graduate of ITP.
Yes. Hi, Dan. So that's a really good question. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is, I mean, independent learning is not necessarily easier than learning in school. It can be harder. And one of the reasons is you have to teach yourself how to evaluate information. So you're going to do that in concert with other people, but you're going to have to make a really concerted effort to figure out how to vet information and how to compare different forms of information and stuff like that.
I mean, some of the times it's very obvious, though. I mean, I think that Chris Bathgate is another story. Can you tell us about him and what he learned? I love this one. This one, I think, I mean,
sure.
I keep saying they're all my favorite, but I think this one is a very instructional tale.
So Chris Bathgate is a machinist artist, and he went to art school and had to work three jobs to pay
afford
his
it.
Way, to afford going to art school. And he wasn't getting a lot out of it. In particular, he felt he was reading all this art theory, but no one was teaching him any skills, and he wanted to make big metal objects, and he wasn't being taught how to use the tools correctly or the physics of metal objects. And so he did a whole year, and then he walked by the school for the first day of his second year and just kept walking and decided...
What was going on in his head?
That it wasn't helping him. And so he decided to put the money into buying himself tools and teaching himself how to use those tools so that he could make the art he wanted to make without it falling apart. So,
and how did it work out for him?
It worked out really well. He's a successful artist. He has galleries and he has art in museums and he sells his own stuff. He also talks about the process of selling your own work and how kind of liberating that is and how being able to make a living as an artist is part of what's really important as much as reputation.
Yeah, yeah. So when he told you that story about walking past the school, did that resonate for you when you decided to leave as well?
Yes and no. I mean, I wasn't in that financial position.
Yeah. That's true. That's what makes this story so cut and dry.
Yeah. But I definitely had a moment of walking by and thinking, not today.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, there's a lot of young people I meet from the radio world that think about going to grad school to learn audio or, you know, which seems preposterous to pay for. And I always say that you can do, you know, one of the great things about, you know, machines cost money to make these giant metal sculptures, whereas with a computer and a microphone, you know, even with film, we're seeing this, you know, over and over and over again, that the money you could spend on going to a film school, you could make two films.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. There are situations where what you want to learn requires, like, a lab and equipment.
So you want to make nukes? Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody did, that kid.
Yes.
But there's also an increasing trend that I really like to see, which is people getting together to share tools and to build spaces for what they need. So there are biohacking spaces and hacker spaces. And there's a space in Brooklyn that's a bio lab where you can go and, you know, do genetic research.
Yeah.
They have all the tools.
So do you think it's getting easier? I mean, I know that, you know, you have a very interesting sample group and that, you know, everyone seems to pull it off. And you know, I would say if I was a 20-year-old reading this, yeah, I would be easily swayed.
Sure.
But I'm wondering, do you think we might be? Are we at the beginning of this, or the middle of something, or is this just, you know, an aberration because, you know, the prices are so just out of whack with what people can.
No, I think we're at the beginning of something. I mean, people have been learning independently, you know, for a long time. And the point is that more and more people are doing it, and we need, as a society, more and more resources for those people and more respect for that kind of learning. If you think about the world of 5 years from now, fewer and fewer people are going to be able to afford a traditional college education or possibly even want one. And so the future is going to be a future in which employers are going to have to learn to evaluate people based on different criteria besides the resume scanner and on their ability to learn, on their portfolio work.
And when you think of, you know, from the point of view of someone trying to evaluate that, like, what would be some of the, you know, like we talked about the resume scanner thing not being able to really do much other than, yes, no, classical. You know, like if we could program this machine from using this group of people, like what would be some of the things that would go into the questionnaire?
I think some of it is the question of like, what have you taught yourself? And how did you go about it? And how would you teach yourself to do the things you need to do this job, rather than assuming that it's about having qualifications right at the outset? I talked to Tony Hsieh, who's the head of Zappos, and he said, I haven't looked at a resume in years. And he didn't just mean him, he meant his whole department. Because for him, it's much more a matter of if you fit the corporate culture, if you have the right kind of attitude, you can train anybody.
You know, coming back to Quinn Norton, someone you brought up earlier, she has this great story about where she would just, you know, her mother told her to smile and nod. She was making furniture and say to the customer, oh, yeah, we'll figure that out. And then just trying to figure it out, which sounds like, okay, that might not work, but it seems like it does every time for so many of the people, not just her. How is that possible?
It's generally referred to as the fake it till you make it approach. And it involves saying, yes, I can do that, closing the door, and then figuring it out. And I haven't run into very many stories of people for whom that didn't work. It also involves a certain amount of humility, and you may have to stretch a deadline because you're still figuring it out or something like that. But one of my first jobs was processing photographs for archaeologists at my college, and I had processed exactly one roll of film and one print, and I said, I can do that, and closed the door. And you know.
Well, we should also say that you did this book, DIY. I mean, the whole process. You started this off with a very successful Kickstarter. And can you talk about? I mean, you've published other books, but you had help, you had publishers. This was all you.
Yes, which is much more of an undertaking than I expected. But yeah, I have a published novel, and when I was thinking about doing this book, I decided that in the spirit of the book, and also so that I could keep the book as I wanted it to be, rather than as the marketing department of a publisher thought that it should be. That I was going to do it myself, and I raised some money on Kickstarter, much more than I expected, which is lucky because I didn't know how to budget any of this. So a lot of that money did get spent, more than you would expect. And I figured it out as I went along. I was lucky in that I know some people who could answer questions for me, including the person who published my novel. But I just made mistake after mistake after mistake, and there are mistakes in the book. And, you know, you learn how to make mistakes and correct them and who you can get information from and cross-referencing information. And I also learned to hire people who could help me. So I hired an amazing editor, and I hired an amazing designer who handled all the talking to printers. I still had to learn what all the decisions meant in printing, like paperweight and size and trim size and the implications of all of those things.
You know, it seems that this self-publishing world, in the dealing with the real world of publishing, especially in a city like New York, I'd love to ask you about the perception of how that is changing. Because it used to be, you know, we would just call this the vanity press. This is not a real book.
Right.
But then we have things like 50 Shades of Grey, which started out as a self-published book. And it's more copies than the Bible and Harry Potter combined.
Is that really true?
Probably not. I think so. maybe not the Bible, but I think the Boy Wizard. Yes, I think more copies. Yeah. So it seems like again, like there's a concrete example from an outsider that those worlds are a little more porous, and you're getting the kind of respect, almost maybe more respect for doing. Is that true?
I don't know about more respect, but it's definitely a different kind of respect. And one thing that's really important for independent publishing is that you have to already have a community. You can't just write a book and publish it on Amazon and say, here it is, world. If you already have a community who's excited about it and can spread the word about it, then that actually, you know, increases both the respect for it and your ability to make any money off of it. So Kickstarter for me was a great way to do that, because I have 1,500 people who bought the book and are really passionate about it and are telling everyone they know.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is it seems that in this new world that having a successful project that you did on your own is actually a credential.
Yes, I think it absolutely is.
I mean, it really turns into one that is quantified. You know, you can put it on. It can probably, they can program the machines to recognize this.
Yes, I made this. Here it is.
We have a few minutes left, about 7 minutes. You can give us a call if you'd like to ask our guest, Keo Stark, any questions about going back to school. The number is 201-209-9368. But I have another comment from the AccuPlaylist. People are shy here. They'd rather write their questions
in.
But this is from Matt, who says he's actually just finished his BFA and a major in sculpture. He can't find work. He's decided to go back to school, and he thinks going back to school for a certificate in web design makes sense for me so I can learn at a quicker pace. Credentials seem to be weighing him down.
The lack of credentials, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I can't tell everyone in the universe not to go back to school. And if you like learning in a school environment and it feels worth it to you financially, go do it. I mean, I'm speaking to people who are really weighing the financial decision, or people who really don't like learning in a school environment. Web design is certainly something you could learn outside of school. But if the credential means something to you in terms of your confidence, then that's your choice.
You know, coming back to the DIY world versus the official, you know, official culture. I guess for me, that metric is always, or figuring out the relationship between those two has always been, the way I think things would actually be different. In other words, once it doesn't matter. I mean, the traditional story is you do the self-publish, and then the publisher people say, "Hey, you've done a great job. We're going to like the 50 Shades of Grey," or you're an artist, and then you're doing it yourself, and you get into a gallery, mm-hmm. and it seems that the real test is like saying, "Okay, I don't need that anymore. I can do it on my, in other words, there's no graduating." And it seems that some of the, at least one, with Molly Crabapple, who's an artist that you talked to, seems to suggest that maybe we're almost there.
Yeah, Molly is a great story. For her, success is making a living and having people appreciate her art. And she talks about the idea, of course, she would be delighted to have a blue chip gallery representing her, but she's not sure she would make as much money for that kind of official art world approval, because she'd have to give half of it to the gallery.
She just did a Kickstarter as well that was very successful.
She's done several. Yeah, she had an amazing show called Shell Game. All the paintings sold out. She sold prints. She is really good at making herself an industry and making beautiful art. She talks about when she was first learning to be an artist, that her approach was she looked at every surface that had art on it and said, "Why isn't that my art?"
Yeah. That's like the next level after fake it till you make it, I guess.
I think one of the points here is that it's not easy. I mean, it's harder than school in a lot of ways, but it's also easier to learn in a meaningful way than school. You can coast through school without learning very much, and you still get the credential. The resume machine is not necessarily looking at your grades. So, but you're going to show up at the job and not know how to learn on your own and not be very passionate about it. I know that in some companies, the very, very, very most important qualification you can have for a job is that the job you're applying for is your dream job. You know, if you can say that convincingly and you're not a nut job, you're in. You're employed.
So are you going to be allowed to teach now that they find out that you've written this book?
Oh, yeah. Several of my backers are people I teach with. So,
All right. Well, Keo Stark, I want to thank you so much for coming in to do the show today on
Thanks.
Too Much Information.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we have a link to your book on the AccuPlaylist. It's called Don't Go Back to School. And you can find a link to it there. Thanks again for the folks writing in on the AccuPlaylist and our imaginary phone callers. We thank you, too. Oh, you know what? We had. Okay. All right. We'll be back next week.
You're listening. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwar the Human Serviette radio show.
To WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar the Human Serviette radio show. Today on the Nardwar the Human Serviette radio show, an interview with Questlove from The Roots. A brand new interview with Questlove, drummer of The Roots. To start with, since Questlove is from Philadelphia, here's MC Breeze with It Ain't New York on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette radio show on WFMU.
Let's see the Bronx, Manhattan, Queens, Brooklyn, Harlem, Jamaica.
Mount Erie, West Philly, the bottom, North Philly, South Philly, West Oak Lane, Bartram Village.
Make it out, that ain't New York.
Yo, hey, Master Flash.
What up, Breeze? We're gonna rock some beef, we're gonna rock so fast.
We all know where we started. And we don't mean to offend. But it ain't New York this time, everybody. 'Cause Philly's stepping in.
With all due respect to New York City, yes, we're fly and we're sedity. He said, Master Flash,
he's MC Breeze, Jeff Carroll, creator of the melodies.
He said, Master Flash, he's the king of the cuts, and any human beatboxer, nail your butt down below the ground. Boom is the sound you will hear when you come into Philly town. No, we're not saying that we're all fresh. We got sucker MCs and boys that fest. But right about now, that's not the point. The point is that Philly's no slummy joint. So put on your sneakers and your underwear, because the BF boys are finally here.
We all know where we started, and we don't mean to offend.
Philadelphia. Who are you?
Who am I? Can we go back to your theme song while I think about it?
You are Questlove.
Yes, I am Questlove. That's exactly who I am. I'm Questlove.
Welcome to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Thank you, Nardwar. I've been waiting for this moment for a long, long time.
And I have a gift for you to welcome you to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Right here, a Motortown Review poster.
Is this the jackpot moment of for you, like when you catch us all off guard? Because right now I've been prepping myself like, I'm not going to get caught. I don't care what he pulls. He can pull Michael Jackson back from the dead. No, I'm not going to get... Yo. This to me... Oh, my... Oh, yo, Willie... Wait, what you find? Yo, I hate when you do this. I love when you do this. But I... man, this...
Now, please, could you explain? What are you laughing at? The ventriloquist right off the bat.
Willie Tyler and Lester. This is... I mean, to me... I'm gonna explain to them why this is important to me. First of all, it's historical, and it's also good to look at. But the type of world that I am involved in now, I am often the epicenter of review shows like this. Like, you know, this summer I'm gonna back up on the 4th of July, different luminaries from all walks of life, and. Like, to me, the Motortown Review is one of the greatest, like, review shows ever. Like, simply because, like, you get an array of different stars. And, God, Willie Tyler and Lester. I mean, they thought of everything. They have comedians, pop acts, young upstarts. You know, the Contours and Gladys Knight and the Pips. I mean, and Stevie Wonder headlining. And... this is amazing. You managed to stump me. You normally wait like four questions in and then you get the sucker punch. But you came in instantly from the top with shocking me. Yes, this means a lot. Wait, is this mine?
That is yours to keep, Questlove.
Okay, good. Because normally you won't be giving shit away. I'm just saying that. I just got a brand new house. This is going up and I'm going to frame this baby. And thank you. I appreciate this.
I'm so excited you like it. First off, though, I want to ask you, Stevie Wonder and the Cosby Show got you into sampling, right?
Absolutely. Many people in the hip-hop world, when they were, you know, the classic era of beat making, many consider the episode